Welcome to Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit podcast, a podcast made by fans of A League of Their Own, the Amazon Prime television series. I'm Emma. My host here with me is Karen. You can find me at PlateLessOrdinary. You can find Karen at Les_Dish. And you can find the podcast at PATOF Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. The past few episodes, we've been going over episodes of the show, but we're going to be doing something different today. We want to discuss more broadly the context in which A League of Their Own exists, the fan fiction world, the media world of queer media, the themes that you see discussing marginalized people, particularly queer women. I want to toss it over to Karen to kick us off with where are we even going to get started on this very special episode?
Emma, I want us to start with the reviews of A League of Their Own, because a lot of the talk that's happening right now about A League of Their Own is the question of renewal and what drives renewal. And so one of the fights that's being played out and has been played out since the start of the series is on reviews and the extent to which these reviews that are online are influencing Amazon's decision or not to renew the show.
Karen, I'm so excited. You know that the reviews, and specifically the insanely horrible reviews, are part of what got me into this show. Because when I was looking this up, I went onto IMDb, and you know, there's always the typical, I liked it, I didn't like it, but you could really see some people who were totally trying to tank the show over the themes that you'd expect, which are really unfair. They're not really criticisms of the show itself. So how do you feel if I read a couple of these?
It's gonna hurt, but do it.
Let me give you an example of a 2-star IMDb review. What a waste. Throw in all of the checklist wokeness required to completely make this classic into something it never was or wanted to be. When character development is minimal, it relies on drum beating for dummies and costume / music to drive forward a story that ultimately leaves you feeling like a cheap date for even watching. I don't know. Did you feel like a cheap date after watching the show?
I did not, and I have literally no idea what that even means.
I mean, it's the wokeness, obviously. Let me read you something else. The writers choosing to throw sex into the audience's faces any chance they could just felt lackadaisical. That was a 2-star review called Meh.
You know what's lackadaisical? There was not enough sex being thrown in my face. I could have handled so much more sex in my face.
Yeah, I mean, there was really not that much sex in the show. We talked about this in previous episodes. I mean, there was some sensuality, but it was pretty tame and limited.
Yeah, I think sometimes when you get reviews like that, you think, did my grandma write this? Because when we look at the direction a lot of shows have gone on the streaming services, White Lotus, House of the Dragon, Game of Thrones, where you have full frontal nudity or very explicit sex. I mean, this show only had what, like basically 2 sex scenes, Max and Gary and Carson and Greta. And as we discussed, Carson and Greta's lasts all of about 3 seconds and Greta kisses a spot of skin above Carson's hip.
Yeah, especially in this era where, as you point out, so many shows go so explicit where it's kind of, I mean, and frankly, a lot of shows go into sexual violence, which to me personally, it can be a lot when you're watching and you're not expecting that. But let me pull up one other review, a 1-star. This is proof Hollywood is running out of ideas. The fact they dismantled the Hanks movie, referring to the original movie, washed it with modern alt-left / woke. The result, a terrible assault of the original movie. This person called it stale, said there are no super talented actors anymore, and cited a bunch of male actors, and said that there was no charisma here, and concluded it with, actors will no longer be needed in the future, computer graphics will take over. Did people think maybe, oh, I just don't like the show and I should keep going? Because so many of these reviews are about, it's too woke. And, you know, that kind of gets to the heart of something that we've talked about, which is these are stories that you didn't see in the past that couldn't be told in the original movie. But it's a known fact that there were many queer people playing in the original Women's League. So it's not that we're recreating history. It's that we're recontextualizing the information in this show. But a lot of these reviewers trying to tank it had a real problem with that.
I think that something that we see is people misunderstanding not only current demographics, but historical demographics. I think when people write things like that, they don't understand that even in modern demographics, and I haven't looked lately, but I remember in the early 2000s, the US population was about 12% Black, 15% Hispanic, 2% Asian. So when they want to see these stories that are only white people, that's not correct. First of all, it's not correct to the US demographic. But as you just said, it's also not correct to the demographic of the actual women that played in this league. There were women of color. There were Canadians. There were definitely queer women. So to want to look retroactively and whitewash the history, that's the problematic view. America has this very rich history that just didn't end up in the history books. But when we think of the Chinese that came in to work on the railroad, or the Indian Punjabis that came and picked oranges, we have this melting pot that is not just the Irish or the Dutch or the white people that came over, but it's all of these people that have come over in time. So when people talk about, oh, well, this isn't historically accurate, well, their own understanding of history is not accurate. And there is such a strong component of racism, whether these people will admit it or not. Because even if it wasn't historically accurate, why would you deny other people the right to have a story told about them? And I think that's some of the culture war that we have right now. Who deserves to have characters? Who deserves to have representation? And whether that's arguments that queer people shouldn't be main characters, or whether that's argument that people of color shouldn't be main characters, that is that very centrism of the, as you like to term it, white cishet viewpoint, which says, well, I should always be the center of attention.
Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to give you another example of a review that just seems so bonkers. This review says, as for the lesbian side of things, even that feels false. And they then cite Rosie O'Donnell from the original, that they want that back. And, like, obviously Rosie appears later in the series and very famously came out. A lot of these reviews feel like people who are saying, I'm not seeing the story that I want to see, and so I'm giving it a 1-star. There are valid criticisms of the show. We talk about that a lot. We have a whole podcast about it. But some of these opinions, like you said, they're just trying to paper over real stories that happened for people and existed. And, you know, I want to talk about this a little bit, even just in terms of typical storytelling for women versus men in sports movies. It's very common to see a sports series where it's a male lead who has a love interest. He has things going on. And I think if you flipped, for example, this show and made some of the characters men, people would not be talking about, oh, there's too much sex. There's too much this or that. It's too woke.
Right. I think you also have to meet the show where it is. What is this show? And this is a story about women, not just one woman. There's multiple main characters. And even the B storylines are relatively strong, the friendship between Max and Clance or whatever, right? So if you come into the show thinking you're going to see the A League of Their Own movie with, in essence, those same actresses and those same themes, no, of course it's not the same thing. This is a different story. But people just really haven't grasped the fact that this is a different goal. It's a different narrative. It's a different format. As you say, there are criticisms that are valid in the sense that people are free to have opinions about what they might have liked to see otherwise. But if you're going to come in and say there was too much sex, well, you might be the problem. The problem is not the show. It might be you.
Yeah.
I do want us to discuss this idea of what storytelling about male athletes and female athletes looks like. But I want us to come back to it later because I think there's still a lot more to be said about these reviews.
I was going to ask you actually related to that. I think you looked a little bit at the reviews on IMDb based on gender, and there's demographics available. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I do. So starting kind of at the top level, there are 21,650 reviews on IMDb, which is huge. Now, what's interesting about that is there's a big skew because 56.7% give it 10 stars and 8.5% give it 1 star. That's not like bookending. There are definitely more positive reviews than negative reviews. But the reason this is important is because there are only, I think, 850 actual written reviews. So what that means is anyone can come in and just give 1 star and leave. And that's what happened when the show was first released. It was a lot of that negative review bombing. a lot of people coming in and just nailing it without even having seen it. And this isn't the first time we've seen a campaign like that, because we saw the same thing happen with, for example, Ghostbusters. A lot of those young white males coming in and leaving negative reviews just in an effort to torpedo the movie.
You know, I just want to say, like you said, frankly, I think it takes away from the valid criticisms that exist. To say, you know, I didn't like, as we've talked about with this show, the CGI baseballs weren't the best. The dialogue being incongruous with the era was a little bit strange. It wasn't clear why they picked certain music. There's lots of things to talk about, but this sort of coming in and plastering and doing one-star reviews that are so hollow, really, it makes you not even want to believe them.
Right. And so the queer community rallied and came in, and a whole bunch of people gave it 10 out of 10 stars in an effort to counteract that. But one thing that I love about IMDb is you can go in and see the rating by demographic. And I think this is where you really start to see where the problem is in the reviews being given. So when we think about the age of the characters, who might be the audience for this, obviously your audience is more likely to be female. When we look at the ratings by demographic, the average rating that women gave this show was 8.5 out of 10. The average that men gave was 6 out of 10. And when we look across the age groups, as IMDb has broken it out, they've broken it out in 4 different age groups: under 18, 18 to 29, 30 to 44, and over the age of 45, men averaged 2 points lower than women. So for example, women up to the age of 29 averaged about 9. 30 to 44, it was 8.5. 45 plus, it was 7.6. But when we look at men, it's 7, or it's 6, or it's 5.7. So men are the ones that are dragging these reviews down.
Let me chime in there again with some more review context that I think is going to be really useful for you. Here's a 1-star review. "This is nothing but a shoehorned load of garbage, a classic feminist movie ruined by these garbage inserts." And another 1-star review. "The contrived racism bits and heckling feel so forced. I started to fast forward through much of the poor me, I am so oppressed parts, as they add no value to the baseball story." I am just going to guess that these are not people who've experienced racism or homophobia or misogyny in their lifetimes, because a lot of those parts of the show were the things that I felt really rang the most true.
Right. Tell me you are not a minority without telling me you're not a minority. It's disappointing to see that the average review for men aged 45 and above was 5.7, because again, they are not the target audience. And they're going in and saying, well, this sucked. Well, it doesn't speak to you, but if you go in and give it negative reviews, then you're hurting the people that it does speak to.
And I mean, I think there's so much out there that already tells other stories. Like, it's fine to say, I really preferred the original movie. Or to say, you know, I really loved Ken Burns' 18-hour documentary on baseball. And I loved the PBS excerpt about the Women's League. That's fine. If you're looking for something historical, that's great. We've talked about before, if you look at something like World War II or the Civil War, there's so many different ways that those stories are told in a documentary version, as well as in a fictionalized version. But people coming in and saying, well, this particular telling was too woke, not historically accurate, too centered on queerness, on women's identity, on race. It just feels like, okay, you don't want any stories that deviate from the thing that you've always seen before.
It's a weird time, I think, in some ways, because if you put it up against, for example, House of the Dragon, I mean, House of the Dragon has incest, it has basically child rape, it has all of these things that are not so great, but the same people that hate A League of Their Own aren't necessarily writing of House of the Dragon, it has too much sex with underage girls, right?
I haven't seen House of the Dragon, but I'm also not going on to the reviews and saying, oh, I saw 5 minutes of it and I'm tanking it.
Right. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. Maybe we should, Emma. Let's take down House of the Dragon.
We should just start a campaign. Just right, us.
Just the two of us.
1-star House of the Dragon. 10 yeah. stars, Air Bud.
Back to Air Bud. Okay, well, you know what? What is the answer to this ratings problem? Honestly, I'm not always sure that these streamers or that anyone should base the majority of their decisions on these reviews because we can see how they can be manipulated.
You know what I think the answer is? I think it is fan fiction.
Ooh.
I think fan fiction is such a great compliment. I want to move into talking about that for a little bit. We're so used to seeing marginalized people through the lens of their trauma, particularly told by other people. If you read about queer history, for example, I mean, I remember, and we're both millennials, Matthew Shepard's death was one of the big main stories in the 90s and 2000s. The musician George Michael being outed from an arrest. Things that were uncomfortable, people getting let go from jobs, people having to hide it in Hollywood. When you think about things you learn about in school, it's slavery for the Black American experience. It's the Holocaust for the Jewish experience. And there's so many other groups like that, be it the Trail of Tears, where it's told through other people capturing history about this trauma. And I really think in many ways, I was never into fan fiction, but getting into it more this year, it's an area in which people can talk about their own stories and explore their trauma, but also they can talk about their joy. And that's something so important that we have discussed on this podcast, being able to express and celebrate your happiness for something that the mainstream doesn't always want to accept.
Yeah. And as we've discussed, fan fiction has just so many different purposes that are very complementary to shows. And, you know, we talk about fan fiction in the context of this queer fiction that's associated with shows. But honestly, fan fiction, it's not just a gay thing. It's not just a straight thing. And it can become canonical. Some of the, in essence, fan fiction for things like Star Trek or Star Wars has become canonical. And so it becomes this other supporting material to a world that someone else has created, right? Someone tells the story of the USS Enterprise or whatever it is. And now people build this other world off it in a way that's really beautiful. And it adds depth and it adds layering and emotion to a story. When we are looking at this story on screen, we only have, if it's 45 minutes or an hour for that episode, there's so much that ends up being off screen. And so people tell those stories that exist off screen in a way that really helps others in the community who are reading this fan fiction feel engaged and part of this broader story.
It's something in some ways that's kind of subversive, that's exploring things, as you said, that aren't on screen, that maybe are not able to be told in canon for various constraints, be it the time constraints, be it subject matter constraints. It can be such a wonderful thing. Fanfic has so much to offer. There's so many great writers out there too. And I was hoping that we could discuss a little bit about specifically the A League of Their Own fanfic, because I know you love to crunch numbers, look at data. Tell me some things that you've seen in the trends there. Specifically, this is on AO3, Archive of Our Own.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff that we can learn by using AO3's filter function. So for example, currently on Archive of Our Own, there are 886 A League of Their Own fan fictions.
I just want to say that's amazing. In only a couple of months, how much people obviously took to this to publish hundreds of stories.
Yeah, to give some context to that, there was a lesbian pairing on a British soap opera, and there are only two fan fictions that have been written about it. So, you know, obviously A League of Their Own was going to have more fan fictions, but you can have pairings that just don't resonate and people don't write fan fiction.
What are kind of the main pairings that you've seen here?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. So 627 of the 886 are Gretzen, and that's not really surprising. But what is surprising is that 186 are Lupe and Jess. And that really shows us that that's a really popular pairing, that people not only like that as a friendship, but that there's a small subset of the fandom that likes imagining, what if you had these two, in essence, butch characters or more masculine presenting characters actually in a relationship?
What was your feeling about that pairing? I mean, obviously Gretzen, fan favorite, set up in canon, clearly, but what do you think about Jess and Lupe?
I would have said that doesn't work, that I think if we go back to my spoon theory about big spoon, small spoon, you have two big spoons. And that when we see them in the gay bar, they're obviously hitting on the same type of women. They're hitting on femme women because they're obviously sleeping with some of the same women. But you know what? It's kind of growing on me. Sure, why shouldn't Lupe and Jess be, in essence, two big spoons that have found a way to make it work?
You know, I feel the same way. I kind of like that friends to lovers sort of arc of like the person who's been in front of you the whole time. Is that our friendship? I don't think so. Who knows?
Moving on.
But no,
Awkward.
in the fictional universe of the person who's been in front of you the whole time, I mean, this is really a short-term thing, though. Like, they really just are kind of meeting and going out. So it's not that long that they've known each other. And it kind of grows on me, too, of like, maybe they realized that something was there. You know, they were just kind of chasing skirts in the bar, but they had a real connection.
I love it. Wouldn't that be subversive? Wouldn't that be unexpected if they, discovered that what they were looking for all along was each other? But here's something else that's really interesting. 57 of those stories, so the third most popular pairing, is actually Joe and Maybelle.
I could see that.
I don't see it at all. There was the line when Joe says she likes blondes and she says it right to Maybelle. But we have Maybelle knitting a jacket or whatever for her child.
I was kind of wondering from the show whether Maybelle is a sexually fluid character or what her deal is. I mean, maybe it's that at home she has a spouse, maybe she has kids. I don't know, but that when she's on the road is sort of when she is having more freedom. I mean, granted, Greta talked about the fact that she's had many relationships with married women before. Is that what we're supposed to be thinking?
I don't know, but I think it's interesting. I'm not quite as interested in that one, but obviously there is part of the fandom that is. Something that I think that's really unfortunate, though, is only 31 of the 886 fan fictions are Max and Esther. And I think that suggests a few things. It tells us, and this won't surprise people, it tells us that most of the writers of fan fiction are white women. Again, this isn't super surprising. It may also tell us that people aren't as invested in the Max and Esther storyline, that if they have more time together in season two, people will be more invested in that. I think that when you're writing fan fiction, people are really interested in the dynamics between two people. And Max and Esther, they didn't have enough time together to create that dynamic, for people to be able to feel like they could replicate that dynamic in different situations.
I read some people's thoughts that they felt like Max and Esther, it was too much of a May-December romance, meaning that Esther, the actress who plays her, is older, that it seemed too apparent that they were different ages and that wasn't connecting for some people. I mean, we talked before about how you've been on a team. It's funny because the team dynamics come into play where Max and Esther are in a different situation because it's not an all-female team. They're the only women there. So I don't know if it seems like it's sort of too convenient for the plot that they're together. But I think you're right too, probably about the demographics of the audience, as well as the fact that we don't meet Esther until later in the show.
I think there's also a spoon question there. Again, reducing things down to big spoon, little spoon, bispoonal is very reductionist, but one gets the sense that Esther's kind of a big spoon, and Max wants to be a big spoon. It's not clear if she is, but there might be a spoon issue there.
I could see that. I think that the relationship between Max and Esther is not going to be the same as between Greta and Carson because Max and Esther seem to have similar personality types. But who knows? Maybe it could be how people are seeing the Jess and Lupe storyline. I really think we're going to need to see in season two, hoping that happens, how things play out.
Yeah, for sure. So moving on, when fiction writers write their fanfics, they can add tags, and the tags enable readers that are skimming through fictions to see what the fiction is going to be about. So some of the tags are commonly seen, but you can tag anything. I could write zebra and it would tag.
Oh, you can tag more than zebra. You can tag a whole string of words. You can tag, I mean, really, the sky's the limit. And especially on a platform like Tumblr, the tags, they hold the special gold.
I love the tags, but looking at the most common ones for A League of Their Own, 161 are tagged fluff, 94 angst, and 72 are modern AU. So it's not surprising that we see fluff. It's not surprising that we see angst. Those are very commonly seen in fan fiction. The modern AU one, I think that one is interesting, and I really think that that speaks to the dynamic of the characters on the show. People like that. They want to see that in various contexts. Where can I place that? Where can I pick that up and drop it? And that's one of the things about fan fiction. You could take A League of Their Own And you could turn it into City of Angels, right? Greta becomes this angel that falls in love with Housewife Carson. Or you could turn it into Sin City, A League of Their Own. That's what people are playing with. That's that really creative, fun aspect of fan fiction.
Just to clarify for people who aren't familiar with fluff and angst, if you can talk a little bit about that and those dynamics.
Yeah, so fluff means that basically the scene you're going to get is something that's really lighthearted. It's really fun. I say this jokingly, but it could be a pillow fight. It's something that carries no stakes. And then angst is going to be something that's very melodramatic, that's going to tug at your heartstrings. It really brings on the pathos. The reason that people would write these things are kind of flip side of the coin. Fluff, because you want to create this happy scene between Greta and Carson. You really want to just live that happy moment that maybe wasn't on the show. And angst is you really want to draw out that drama. You want people to feel it. You want all of the emotions packaged in a way that's kind of going to hurt a little bit.
I think when you read a lot of fictions, they do have those two sides of the coin. And that makes a really compelling story in general. Another related to fluff angst would be the hurt comfort. Something goes wrong for a character, and then usually another character is coming to that person's aid. That's a very common trope. You know, I'm not surprised at all about the modern AU, because I do think that with the dialogue being more modern type of dialogue, with the storylines and characters living relatively openly in their identities, it lends itself to imagining what would it be like if they were just living in today's times. I mean, and that I think would be a really different but interesting show if this was set in 2022 and they were playing in a women's softball league together and they had this relationship.
I would watch that show.
You could make that show.
Or I could write it.
You could write it. And that's something that I want to talk about. People may not know, Karen is quite the prolific author in queer fiction. I am wondering, how has your process of writing changed since you started writing your novels?
Well, that's kind of a big question, but I'll actually tie it into fan fiction. One of the things that I've learned from fan fiction is that, again, people are invested in interpersonal dynamics. So when I first started writing, it was like, okay, what matters is the story, is fighting the dragon, is stopping the bad mage. But fan fiction shows that what people attach to is the romance, or is the dynamic between two characters or three characters, the group of people, right? People are really invested in the emotional content of a story.
I just want to say that's where I think fan fiction really tends to appeal to a more female audience, because a lot of mainstream stories, mainstream movies and film, they don't explore those inner lives and those sort of slice of life, interpersonal relationship dynamics, or even when a romance is featured, it tends to be part of someone's larger story arc rather than we're going to focus on just the romance, unless it's pigeonholed as this is a romance, unless it's, oh, well, this is a Hallmark movie. This is a rom-com, which has kind of fallen out of favor and popularity recently. Otherwise, the idea of just focusing on romance and relationships isn't done as much, but you can see that there's a huge audience for it with the fanfic world.
Right. So what I've taken from that is, for some of the relationships that I've written in some of my books, it's been inspired by the dynamics that I've seen between, let's say, a TV couple. Hey, I like this dynamic between these two. I'm not writing AU. I'm not writing alternate universe. But I'm trying to tease out, what do I like about that relationship and how do I move that into a new context? So for me, that was kind of the learning thing that I drew from fan fiction. I'm still learning and I'm still working at that. And so when I write fan fiction, I'm writing about these interpersonal dynamics between these characters because I'm trying to polish that aspect of my writing.
I do think that writing is a learning curve for all of us. And I think also finding your voice, finding your audience. I mean, even as we've discussed about with this podcast, it's like, who's our audience? Who wants to hear us? And, you know, that's why it's so important when people send us feedback, when they send us messages, comment on our social media, because creating something is very special, but creating something and knowing that it affects somebody else, I think is one of the best things about particularly fan fiction. Seeing the comments, seeing the discussions that are going on, that's how things take on a new life. And as you said, they can become canon, or they certainly become, as it's called, someone's headcanon.
Right. And that's something that every fan fiction writer knows, any writer in general, is that kudos, feedback, that's what keeps you going. And you can write a fan fiction that gets 50 kudos, but that doesn't give you warm fuzzies. Those are just a number. It's when someone writes something that feels good. You see a comment has been posted to AO3 and you rush to see what that comment is, because all of this creation aspect requires an audience. Knowing that there's an audience that's engaged, that cares enough to write something, is huge. And that's something that if you're a fanfic reader, if you're a reader in general, to know that just a like on social media or a like on AO3 means much less to the writer than a comment. You didn't have to love the fiction. You didn't have to love the book. You didn't have, whatever it is, giving that feedback is kind of the encouragement that keeps the author going. You know, I think on one of my fictions, it's like, we'll write for comments, because there's truth there. It really is what inspires you to keep going.
I think also, circling back to our earlier conversation, as we see with some of these IMDb reviews where people are tired of the wokeness and the feminism, there's a lot of spheres in which these kinds of stories, they're ripe for being attacked. And as you said, fan fiction is not just limited to stories about lesbians, stories about queer women. It's people exploring many aspects. Some of the fan fictions that I follow, they're male-female pairings, they're gay men, they're whatever. And usually it's just that it's marginalized characters who, for whatever reason, their stories were not told. I think about if you see, again, like a typical traditional sports movie with the male hero, there's always the man, the baseball star, the Kevin Costner, and then he's got the funny, pudgy friend who's just there to be quirky, and the female love interest who's just there to sort of support him and help him unlock his potential. But fan fiction is the area in which, hey, maybe the friend is actually the hero now. Maybe the friend has a love story and he meets his wife, and that could be really exciting. Maybe the female character is the one who, you know, it's all about her inner life. And so I think when you're used to seeing criticism and you're used to seeing only certain types of stories being centered, it's exciting to read a place where people are just exploring what they want to see.
Yeah, something to add to that that I was thinking about earlier today, for anyone that watched the Apple TV show Dickinson, it was a great show, but it was an uneven show. And what I was thinking this morning is the queer community got really excited because it showed this relationship between Sue and Emily. But in fact, the show went 3 seasons. And throughout those 3 seasons, it was also like a lot of Emily having these moments kind of dating or being interested in these guys. And I'm betting if you actually timed out the scenes, she really spends much less time with Sue. It's kind of tilted more heavily towards the men. And yet, of course, the fan fiction is going to tilt more towards Emma Sue. Again, it's this idea of building out that story that wasn't on screen. There was supposed to be this awesome romance between Emma Sue that really didn't play out. You kept watching each episode, like, is this the time they actually get together? In that case, maybe we can see Sue's perspective, or maybe we can see the relationship, or what did the relationship look 10 years down the line that the show just never gave us?
I really like finding fandoms where it's like, okay, you guys were all watching the same thing I was, or you were all thinking what I was, which is these characters have a lot of chemistry. They always seem to be in these situations together, but for whatever reason, the story is not focused on them. There's some other love interest, there's some other main plot, and we never get to see like what plays out. It's always kind of left in the background. It feels like it's left on the cutting room floor. And I think, and I've read, you know, sometimes it is for marketability. We want to put whoever is the biggest name star, we want to put whatever we think will draw the biggest broad audience, instead of making it something that's targeted and tailored. And I think, again, some of these IMDb reviews show why, because when you have the original A League of Their Own movie that appeals to a broad group, but all of a sudden you have something with certain different types of stories in it, some people get really mad about it.
Yeah, something that seems to me to be different from most other fandoms where I've read the fan fiction is that the A League of Their Own fan fictions run a lot longer. So when I think of fan fictions Obviously, there's a big variation from a few hundred words to thousands of words. The longest fanfic right now on AO3 is 87,000 words, and it's not even finished yet. To give people context, your average romance book is around 60,000 words. Your average action, adventure, sci-fi is 100,000 words. So you're really looking at someone who has now written the equivalent of an entire book on Gretzen.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And the most read fic has 48,000 words. That's a Hurt Comfort one. And it does involve the whole team, but it's a Gretzen fic. And then the second most common is a modern Gretzen AU with 28,000 words. So what I learned from that is that this particular audience, they want to be immersed. They want to hear this long story. They're not here for a one-shot. They're not here for a 3,000 word fic like I am. They're really looking for this longer story that they can really dig into and live vicariously through.
I think, again, that speaks to probably some of the world building. I'm not super familiar with these fics. I haven't read them. But I would imagine that when you're talking about that length, you're creating a world, you're creating backstories for characters. The sort of way that when, as you mentioned, sort of the one shot, which is just, oh, hey, here's a little story that happens kind of in one time and place, that builds on, we know a lot about characters so far. We understand a lot, and maybe we're adding a couple of new details. But I would imagine that if you're writing 20, 30, 40, 50, 80,000 words, you're creating a whole world.
Definitely. And I think in some ways that's good for the League of Their Own creators to know that in fact, this entire ecosystem exists and there is that hunger for additional information, for additional backstory, for additional depth and details.
So let me ask, is there anything else that you feel like we haven't covered with so many great topics today?
Yeah, I want us to go back to talking about this idea of marginalized stories as normally being trauma stories. So when you and I talked about this earlier this week, you made a really good point that a lot of times when Hollywood tells a story about a minority group, it really presses on one single moment, one single traumatic moment for them. So Black stories tend to be about slavery, or if they've moved past slavery, it's still racism. Jews and the Holocaust. It's tugging at the viewer's heartstrings, but it also reinforces the trauma. A League of Their Own really breaks that trend by focusing on positives. It's not like, my God, look at the persecution of queer people in the 1940s. Yes, it's there. We have the police breaking into the bar. And by the way, that is traumatic. That is terribly traumatic. I hate watching that scene. And I hate even more when they're sitting in The Wizard of Oz and Greta won't let Carson hold her hand. But yeah, I don't even know if people that are not part of that minority group realize the extent to which it's always these sad stories.
I think when you talk to people who live those experiences, it really invalidates, again, some of these ridiculous comments that are posted online. Because as you know personally, if you've been out with a same-sex partner, maybe you're thinking about, is this a place in which I can hold hands? Is this a place in which I can show affection? I've definitely had times as a Jewish person where I think it would be better if I don't tell people about my religion, because once I bring that up, they will treat me differently. Or could I be in danger? You know, unfortunately, as we know in the news, be it another shooting at a queer bar, which just happened, be it a shooting at a Black church, a Jewish synagogue, attacked by nationalists, it can be a very scary time. And so seeing those things, they can be very painful and they can remind you of things that you've lived and things that you see on social media and in the news. And the way that those stories are told as sort of your personhood is tied so closely to victimhood, and then other people saying, well, you're just making yourself a victim. It's nice to have a space in which you can tell a story. And if you want to talk about trauma, then you can talk about trauma. But if you also want to tell a story about how you are in love with characters and you're talking through their lens and giving them life, free from, again, the IMDb reviewers who are going to say you're too quote-unquote woke. That's a really nice and a really powerful and, again, very kind of subversive thing.
Yeah, it's kind of like if every movie about a woman was just the Salem Witch Trials. You can tell stories about minority groups where it's not just the bad. And I think there has historically just been this tendency to be like, oh, hey, remember that time the gays were mistreated? Yes, everyone knows that historically homophobia has existed, that bad things have happened. But you can tell a story in which at the end of season one, Greta and Carson can kiss on the porch and someone hasn't immediately shown up with pitchforks and burning torches.
Yeah, but it's frustrating when in mainstream media, then people will say, well, there's too much of this. It's like, oh, but didn't you get your one queer lead story? Why do we need more of this? Or like, didn't you get your one Asian American superhero?
Right.
Why do we need more?
Too gay, right? I love when we get these comments about something being too gay, because no one ever says, wow, that show was too straight. I mean, gay people do, but you know, like heterosexual viewers do not watch something and go, man, that show was just so straight. It was just, oh, it was rubbed in my face. I think that comes back to this idea of when you're used to not seeing minorities, then when you see them, all of a sudden you think it's disproportionate or excessive. It's like, no, that's not actually, you're just not used to seeing it.
I agree. And I think around this time of year too, again, with the Hallmark movies, there is beginning to be a change where there are different families included and different families shown. But it's really easy to put on TV and all you see is a white Christian cishet family and that pairing. And, you know, maybe you get the one queer story or you get the one Hanukkah episode. And I know for me, I get so excited, especially now that I have children, of like, wow, I can have a Hanukkah show. Actually, there's a show that is on Disney Plus called Firebuds. Firebuds is about kids and their talking fire trucks and cars and stuff. The main protagonist, I didn't realize this until several episodes in, he's half Filipino and half white Jewish American. They show him during Hanukkah, and there's an episode where his Filipino grandpa is having lumpia, and they're discussing foods and celebration. Other characters on the show, there's a girl whose parents are a lesbian couple. There's a character who's in a wheelchair, but it's not treated like, oh, we're just gonna, you know, again, like these reviewers, put it in your face.
That sounds so woke, Emma.
The thing is, it's not treated that way. I had the show on for many episodes, just kind of on streaming. And it wasn't until several episodes in when I noticed, oh, like these are different kinds of kids and these are different kinds of families. That's nice that it's not being focused of, oh, they get one very special episode to show that they're different. They actually get to be the stars. And I think that's something great. And especially for me having children, that I want to show them that people look different. People are different. And it's okay for them to just be existing rather than you get highlighted one time, you get 1 month per year to talk about your issues. And then that's it.
Yeah. I want to go back to something. We briefly mentioned sports movies and women's sports movies. I Googled women's sports movies, and we know that Google's not going to pull up everything, but it really shows you how uncommon it is for Hollywood to create sports movies for women. I mean, I was getting movies that I would not have classified in that way. I thought that of the movies that I was offered, Bennett Like Beckham was kind of the most similar to A League of Their Own, the TV show. And, you know, I thought it was really interesting because for viewers who might not be familiar, that was originally supposed to be a lesbian love story in which Parminder Nagra, who was the lead, was supposed to fall in love with Keira Knightley's character. So it was interracial. And then Gurinder Chadha was the director and her friend was like, you know, this won't do well if it's a lesbian love story. You should make it heterosexual if you want it to be successful. And so the story became this South Asian falls in love with an Irish coach who is experiencing, in essence, the discrimination of the British. It was a global smash hit and it did so well. But again, how do we tell these stories of women? And as you said, the stories that we tell about women in sports are very different from the stories that we tell about men in sports. Mm-hmm. I like how we tell women in sports stories, but it's much more community-based. Again, it's about the interpersonal relationships. It's not the man story where he's a boxer who wants to do his last fight and he's got that girlfriend supporting him and blah, blah, blah.
Although I have to admit, I love Rocky. And if you see those movies, they surprise me about the themes because I think older movies, there was more time to develop story and plot. I think now we're especially living in an era in which everything is so big, so over the top with production and has to be so fast paced. In part because you get the reaction so fast, like again with this IMDb thing, you see immediately the temperature and what people are thinking. When it comes to women in sports, I can't think of movies really other than Bend It Like Beckham that were such smash hits. And that illustrates too how women's stories in general are often chasing after someone. It just kind of gets tiring, you know? It's really not as much what I would like to see, which is even when you have a straight woman being like, hey, I'm being successful and there's a guy here who's supporting me and he's part of my journey, instead of I'm chasing this guy for my happiness. Because very often too, we don't see women who are able to have career success and romantic success and other sort of joy in their personal lives. It's seen as, well, you have to pick.
Plug for the Ali Wong movie, Always Be My Maybe, which really gets into that she's got this successful career and the guy has to grapple with the fact that he's less successful. He's going to be the one holding her clutch on the red carpet. Really well done.
I really enjoyed that movie. And also, again, seeing different faces leading a rom-com, a different type of story that I'm sure some people, I have not pulled up the IMDb reviews, but I'm sure some people pigeonhole it as, well, why are there so many Asians in this movie? But like, you can tell a universal story. And that's what I think about. Fanfic, A League of Their Own, everything that we're talking about, it ultimately comes down to universal human experiences. And it doesn't matter what your partner looks like or their gender, or if it's not a romantic relationship, if it is a friendship, as we've talked about, that's something I actually think is some of the strongest writing by Abby Jacobson. I think the friendship that's portrayed, because I know for me, having friends is so important. And I would think of some of those friendships as really building blocks in my life.
That is a beautiful way to wrap up this episode.
Well, I am glad everybody joined us for a very special and different discussion. And I hope people are thinking about their friends, and I hope people go onto their favorite fanfics and leave a comment today.
That's right. So when we come back next time, we will return to talking about episodes of A League of Their Own. Thank you for listening to this very special intermission episode, and we will catch you next time.